Newton Media Group, a family of creative services, presents the Voice Over Work podcast. On the podcast today, we take a little deeper look into a book introduced in a previous podcast with a chapter-by-chapter look at The Discourses of Epictetus by Epictetus, narrated by Russell Newton. 2. Chapter 1. That confidence is not inconsistent with caution. The opinion of the philosophers, perhaps, seems to some to be a paradox, but still, let us examine, as well as we can, if it is true that it is possible to do everything both with caution and with confidence. For caution seems to be, in a manner, contrary to confidence, and contraries are in no way consistent. That which seems to many to be a paradox in the matter under consideration, in my opinion, is of this kind. If we asserted that we ought to employ caution, and, in the same things, men might justly accuse us of bringing together things which cannot be united. But now, where is the difficulty in what is said? For if these things are true, which have been often said and often proved, that the nature of good is in the use of appearances, and the nature of evil likewise, and that things independent of our will do not admit either the nature of evil nor of good, what paradox do the philosophers assert if they say that there were things are not dependent on the will, there you should employ confidence, but where they are dependent on the will, there you should employ caution? For if the bad consists in a bad exercise of the will, caution ought only to be used where things are dependent on the will. But if things independent of the will and not in our power are nothing to us, with respect to these, we must employ confidence, and thus we shall both be cautious and confident, and, indeed, confident because of our caution. For by employing caution toward things which are really bad, it will result that we shall have confidence with respect to things which are not so. We are then in the condition of deer. Chapter 2. Of Tranquility. Consider, you who are going into court, what you wish to maintain, and what you wish to succeed in. For if you wish to maintain a will conformable to nature, you have every security, every facility. You have no troubles. For if you wish to maintain what is in your own power and is naturally free, and if you are content with these, what else do you care for? For who is the master of such things? Who can take them away? If you choose to be modest and faithful, who shall not allow you to be so? If you choose not to be restrained or compelled, who shall compel you to desire what you think that you ought not to desire? Who shall compel you to avoid what you do not think fit to avoid? But what do you say? The judge will determine against you something that appears formidable, but that you should also suffer in trying to avoid it, how can he do that? When then the pursuit of objects and the avoiding of them are in your power, what else do you care for? Let this be your preference, this your narrative, this your confirmation, this your victory, this your peroration, this your applause. Therefore, Socrates said to one who was reminding him to prepare for his trial, "Do you not think, then, that I have been preparing for it all my life?" By what kind of preparation? I've maintained that which was in my own power. How then? I've never done anything unjust, either in my private or in my public life. But if you wish to maintain externals also, your poor body, your little property, and your little estimation, I advise you to make from this moment all possible preparation, and then consider both the nature. Chapter 3. To Those Who Recommend Persons to Philosophers. Diogenes said well to one who asked from him letters of recommendation. "That you are a man," he said, "he will know as soon as he sees you, and he will know whether you are good or bad, if he is, by experience, skillful to distinguish the good and the bad. But if he is without experience, he will never know if I write to him 10,000 times. For it is just the same as if a drachma asked to be recommended to a person to be tested. If he is skillful in testing silver, he will know what you are, for you will recommend yourself. We ought then in life also to have some skill, as in the case of silver coin, that a man may be able to say, like the judge of silver, bring me any drachma, and I will test it. But in the case of syllogisms, I would say, bring any man that you please, and I will distinguish for you the man who knows how to resolve syllogisms, and the man who does not. Why? Because I know how to resolve syllogisms. I have the power, which a man must have, who is able to deliver those who have the power of resolving syllogisms. But in life, how do I act? At one time I call a thing good, and at another time bad. What is the reason? The contrary to that which is in the case of syllogisms, ignorance and inexperience. Chapter 4. Against a person who had once been detected in adultery. As Epictetus was saying that man is formed for fidelity, and that he who subverts fidelity subverts the peculiar characteristic of men, there entered one of those who are considered to be men of letters, who had once been detected in adultery in the city. Then Epictetus continued, "But if we lay aside this fidelity for which we are formed and make designs against our neighbor's wife, what are we doing? What else but destroying and overthrowing? Whom? The man of fidelity, the man of modesty, the man of sanctity. Is this all? And are we not overthrowing neighborhood and friendship and the community? And in what place are we putting ourselves? How shall I consider you, men, as a neighbor? As a friend? What kind of one? As a citizen? Wherein shall I trust you? So, if you were an utensil so worthless that a man could not use you, you would be pitched out on the dung heaps, and no man would pick you up. But if, being a man, you are unable to fill any place which befits a man, what shall we do with you? For suppose that you cannot hold the place of a friend, can you hold the place of a slave? And who will trust you? Are you not then content that you also should be pitched somewhere on a dung heap as a useless utensil and a bit of dung? Then you will say, no man cares for me, a man of letters. They do not, because you're bad and useless. It is just as if the wasps complained because no man cares for them, but all fly from them, and if a man can, he strikes them and knocks them down. You have such a sting. Chapter 5. How magnanimity is consistent with care. Things themselves are indifferent, but the use of them is not indifferent. How then shall a man preserve firmness and tranquility, and at the same time be careful, and neither rash nor negligent? If he imitates those who play at dice, the counters are indifferent. The dice are indifferent. How do I know what the cast will be? But to use carefully and dexterously the cast of the dice, this is my business. Thus in life also the chief business is this: distinguish and separate things, and say, externals are not in my power. Will is in my power. Where shall I seek the good and the bad? Within, in the things which are my own. But in what does not belong to you, call nothing either good or bad, or profit or damage, or anything of the kind. What then? Should we use such things carelessly? In no way, for this, on the other hand, is bad for the faculty of the will, and, consequently, against nature. But we should act carefully, because the use is not indifferent, and we should also act with firmness and freedom from perturbations, because the material is indifferent. For where the material is not indifferent, there no man can hinder me, nor compel me. Where I can be hindered and compelled, the obtaining of those things is not in my power, nor is it good or bad. But the use is either bad or good, and the use is in my power. But it is difficult to mingle and to bring together these two things, the carefulness of him who is affected by the matter, and the firmness of him who has no regard for it. But it is not impossible. And if it is, happiness is impossible. But we should act as... Chapter 6. Of Indifference. The hypothetical proposition is indifferent. The judgment about it is not indifferent, but it is either knowledge or opinion or error. Thus, life is indifferent. The use is not indifferent. When any man tells you that these things also are indifferent, do not become negligent. And when a man invites you to be careful, do not become abject and struck with admiration of material things. And it is good for you to know your own preparation and power, that in those manners where you have not been prepared, you may keep quiet and not be vexed if others have the advantage over you. For you, too, in syllogisms will claim to have the advantage over them, and if others should be vexed at this, you will console them by saying, I have learned them and you have not. Thus also, where there is need of any practice, seek not that which is required from the need, but yield in that matter to those who have had practice, and be yourself content with firmness of mind. Go and salute a certain person. How? Not meanly. But I've been shut out, for I have not learned to make my way through the window, and when I have found the door shut, I must either come back or enter through the window. But still speak to him. In what way? Not meanly. But suppose that you have not got what you wanted. Was this your business and not his? Why then do you claim that which belongs to another? Always remember what is your own and what belongs to another, and you will not be disturbed. Chrysippus therefore said, well, so long as future things are uncertain, I always cling to those which are more adapted to the conservation of that which is according to nature. For God. Chapter 7. How We Ought to Use Divination. Through an unreasonable regard to divination, many of us omit many duties. For what more can the diviner see than death or danger or disease, generally things of that kind? If then I must expose myself to danger for a friend, and if it is my duty even to die for him, what need have I then for divination? Have I not within me a diviner who has told me the nature of good and of evil, and has explained to me the signs of both? What need have I then to consult the viscera of victims or the flight of birds, and why do I submit when he says, it is for your interest? For does he know what is for my interest? Does he know what is good? And as he has learned the signs of the viscera, has he also learned the signs of good and evil? For if he knows the signs of these, he knows the signs both of the beautiful and of the ugly, and of the just and of the unjust. Do you tell me, man, what is the thing which is signified for me? Is it life or death, poverty or wealth? But whether these things are for my interest or whether they are not, I do not intend to ask you. Why don't you give your opinion on matters of grammar? And why do you give it here about things on which we are all in error and disputing with one another? The women, therefore, who intended to send by a vessel a month's provision to Gratilla in her banishment, made a good answer to him who said that Domitian would seize what she sent. I would rather, she replied, that Domitian should seize all than that I should not send it. What then leads us to frequent use of divination? Cowardice, the dread of what will happen. This is the reason. Chapter 8. What is the nature of the good? God is beneficial, but the good also is beneficial. It is consistent, then, that where the nature of God is, there also the nature of the good should be. What, then, is the nature of God? Flesh? Certainly not. An estate in land? By no means. Fame? No. Is it intelligence, knowledge, right reason? Yes. Herein, then, simply seek the nature of the good, for I suppose that you do not seek it in a plant. No. Do you seek it in an irrational animal? No. If then you seek it in a rational animal, why do you still seek it anywhere except in the superiority of rational over irrational animals? Now, plants have not even the power of using appearances, and for this reason, you do not apply the term good to them. The good then requires the use of appearances. Does it require this use only?
For if you say that it requires this use only, say that the good, and that happiness and unhappiness are in irrational animals also. But you do not say this, and you do right. For if they possess, even in the highest degree, the use of appearances, yet they have not the faculty of understanding the use of appearances, and there is good reason for this, for they exist for the purpose of serving others, and they exercise no superiority. For the ass, I suppose, does not exist for any superiority over others, no, but because we had need of a back which is able to bear something, and in truth we had need also of his being able to walk, and for this reason he received also the faculty of making use of appearances, for otherwise. Chapter 9. That when we cannot fulfill that which the character of a man promises, we assume the character of a philosopher. It is no common thing to do this only, to fulfill the promise of a man's nature. For what is a man? The answer is, a rational and mortal being. Then, by the rational faculty, from whom are we separated? From wild beasts. And from what others? From sheep and like animals. Take care, then, to do nothing like a wild beast. But if you do, you have lost the character of a man. You have not fulfilled your promise. See that you do nothing like a sheep, but if you do, in this case, the man is lost. What then do we do as sheep? When we act gluttonously, when we act lewdly, when we act rashly, filthily, inconsiderately, to what have we declined? To sheep? What have we lost? The rational faculty. When we act contentiously and harmfully and passionately and violently, to what have we declined? To wild beasts. Consequently, some of us are great wild beasts, and others little beasts, of a bad disposition and small, whence we may say, let me be eaten by a lion. But in all these ways, the promise of a man acting as a man is destroyed. For when is a conjunctive proposition maintained? When it fulfills what its nature promises. So that the preservation of a complex proposition is when it is a conjunction of truths. When is a disjunctive maintained? When it fulfills what it promises. When are flutes, a lyre, a horse, a dog preserved? What is the wonder, then, if a man also in like manner is preserved? And Chapter 10. How we may discover the duties of life from names. Consider who you are. In the first place, you are a man, and this is one who has nothing superior to the faculty of the will, but all other things subjected to it, and the faculty itself he possesses unenslaved and free from subjection. Consider them from what things you have been separated by reason. You've been separated from wild beasts. You've been separated from domestic animals. Further, you are a citizen of the world and a part of it. Not one of the subservient, but one of the principal parts, for you are capable of comprehending the divine administration and of considering the connection of things. What then does the character of a citizen promise? To hold nothing as profitable to himself, to deliberate about nothing as if he were detached from the community, but to act as the hand or foot would do, if they had reason and understood the constitution of nature, for they would never put themselves in motion, nor desire anything otherwise than with reference to the whole. Therefore, the philosophers say well that if the good man had foreknowledge of what would happen, he would cooperate toward his own sickness and death and mutilation, since he knows that these things are assigned to him according to the universal arrangement, and that the whole is superior to the part, and the state to the citizen. But now, because we do not know the future, it is our duty to stick to the things which are in their nature more suitable for our choice, for we were made, among other things, for this. After this, remember that you are a son. What does this character promise? To consider that everything which is the son's belongs. Chapter 11. What the beginning of philosophy is. The beginning of philosophy to him at least, who enters on it in the right way and by the door, is a consciousness of his own weakness and inability about necessary things. For we come into the world with no natural notion of a right-angled triangle, or of a diocese, or of a half-tone, but we learn about each of these things by a certain transmission according to art. And for this reason, those who do not know them do not think that they know them. But as to good and evil, and beautiful and ugly, and becoming and unbecoming, and happiness and misfortune, and proper and improper, and what we ought to do and what we ought not to do, whoever came into the world without having an innate idea of them? Wherefore, we all use these names, and we endeavor to fill the preconceptions to the several cases thus. He has done well, he has not done well. He has done as he ought, not as he ought. He has been unfortunate, he has been fortunate. He is unjust, he is just. Who does not use these names? Who among us defers the use of them till he has learned them, as he defers the use of the words about lines or sounds? And the cause of this is that we come into the world already taught, as it were, by nature, some things on this matter, and proceeding from these, we have added to them self-conceit. For why, a man asks, do I not know the beautiful and the ugly? Have I not the notion of it? You have. Do I not adapt it to particulars? You do. Do I not then adapt it properly? In that lies the whole question, and conceit is added here. For beginning from these things which are admitted, men proceed to that which is... Chapter 12. Of Disputation or Discussion. What things a man must learn in order to be able to apply the art of disputation has been accurately shown by our philosophers, but with respect to the proper use of the things, we are entirely without practice. Only give to any of us, whom you please, an illiterate man to discuss with, and he cannot discover how to deal with the man. But when he has moved the man a little, if he answers beside the purpose, he does not know how to treat him, but he then either abuses or ridicules him and says, "He's an illiterate man. It's not possible to do anything with him." Now a guide, when he has found a man out of the road, leads him into the right way. He does not ridicule or abuse him and then leave him. Do you also show this illiterate man the truth, and you will see that he follows. But so long as you do not show him the truth, do not ridicule him, but rather feel your own incapacity. How then did Socrates act? He used to compel his adversary in disputation to bear testimony to him, and he wanted no other witness. Therefore he could say, "I care not for other witnesses, but I am always satisfied with the evidence of my adversary, and I do not ask the opinion of others, but only the opinion of him who is disputing with me." For he used to make the conclusions drawn from natural notions so plain that every man saw the contradiction and withdrew from it. Does the envious man rejoice? By no means, but he is rather pained. Well, do you think that envy is pain over evils? And what envy is there of evils? Therefore, he made his adversary say that envy is pain over good things. Well then, Chapter 13, On Anxiety. When I see a man anxious, I say, "What does this man want? If he did not want something which is not in his power, how could he be anxious?" For this reason, a lute player, when he is singing by himself, has no anxiety. But when he enters the theater, he is anxious, even if he has a good voice and plays well on the lute, for he not only wishes to sing well, but also to obtain applause. But this is not in his power. Accordingly, where he has skill, there he has confidence. Bring any single person who knows nothing of music, and the musician does not care for him. But in the matter where a man knows nothing and has not been practiced, there he is anxious. What matter is this? He knows not what a crowd is or what the praise of a crowd is. However, he has learned to strike the lowest chord and the highest, and what the praise of the many is, and what power it has in life, he neither knows nor has he thought about it. Hence, he must of necessity tremble and grow pale. I cannot then say that a man is not a lute player when I see him afraid, but I can say something else, and not one thing but many. And first of all, I call him a stranger and say, this man does not know in what part of the world he is, but though he has been here so long, he is ignorant of the laws of the state and the customs, and what is permitted and what is not, and he has never employed any lawyer to tell him and to explain the laws. But a man does not write a will if he does not know how it ought to be written, or he employs a person who does know, nor does he rashly seal a bond or write a security, but he uses his desire without a lawyer's advice, and aversion, and pursuit, and attempt and purpose. Chapter 14. To Naso. When a certain Roman entered with his son and listened to one reading, Epictetus said, this is the method of instruction. And he stopped. When the Roman asked him to go on, Epictetus said, every art, when it is taught, causes labor to him who is unacquainted with it and is unskilled in it. And indeed, the things which proceed from the arts immediately show their use in the purpose for which they were made, and most of them contain something attractive and pleasing. For indeed, to be present and to observe how a shoemaker learns is not a pleasant thing, but the shoe is useful, and also not disagreeable to look at. And the discipline of a smith, when he is learning, is very disagreeable to one who chances to be present and is a stranger to the art. But the work shows the use of the art. But you will see this much more in music. For if you are present while a person is learning, the discipline will appear most disagreeable, and yet the results of music are pleasing and delightful to those who know nothing of music. And here we conceive the work of a philosopher to be something of this kind. He must adapt his wish to what is going on, so that neither any of the things which are taking place shall take place contrary to our wish, nor any of the things which do not take place shall not take place when we wish that they should. For this the result is to those who have so arranged the work of philosophy, not to fall in the desire, nor to fall in with that which they would avoid, without uneasiness, without fear, without perturbation, to pass through life themselves, together with their associates, maintaining the relations both natural and acquired, as the relation of son, of father, of brother, of citizen, of man, of wife. Chapter 15. To or against those who obstinately persist in what they have determined. When some persons have heard these words, that a man ought to be constant, and that the will is naturally free and not subject to compulsion, but that all other things are subject to hindrance, to slavery, and are in the power of others, they suppose that they ought, without deviation, to abide by everything which they have determined. But in the first place, that which has been determined ought to be sound. I require tone in the body, but such as exists in a healthy body, in an athletic body. But if it is plain to me that you have the tone of a frenzied man and you boast of it, I shall say to you, man, seek the physician. This is not tone, but atony. In a different way, something of the same kind is felt by those who listen to these discourses in a wrong manner, which was the case with one of my companions who, for no reason, resolved to starve himself to death. I heard of it when it was the third day of his abstinence from food, and I went to inquire what had happened. I have resolved, he said. But still, tell me what it was which induced you to resolve. For if you have resolved rightly, we shall sit with you and assist you to depart. But if you've made an unreasonable resolution, change your mind. We ought to keep to our determinations. What are you doing, man? We ought to keep not to all our determinations, but to those which are right. For if you are now persuaded that it is right, do not change your mind, if you think fit, but persist and say, we ought to abide by our determinations. Will you not make the beginning and lay the foundation in an inquiry, whether the determination is sound or not sound, so then build on it firmness? Chapter 16. That we do not strive to use our opinions about good and evil. Where is the good in the will? Where is the evil in the will? Where is neither of them in those things which are independent of the will? Well then, does anyone among us think of these lessons out of the schools? Does anyone meditate by himself to give an answer to things as in the case of questions? Is it day? Yes. Is it night? No. Well, is the number of stars even? I cannot say. When money is shown to you, have you studied to make the proper answer that money is not a good thing? Have you practiced yourself in these answers, or only against sophisms? Why do you wonder, then, if in the cases which you have studied, in those you have improved, but in those which you have not studied, in those you remain the same? When the rhetorician knows that he has written well, that he has committed to memory what he has written, and brings an agreeable voice, why is he still anxious? Because he is not satisfied with having studied. What then does he want, to be praised by the audience? For the purpose, then, of being able to practice declamation, he has been disciplined, but with respect to praise and blame, he has not been disciplined. For when did he hear from anyone what praise is, what blame is, what the nature of each is, what kind of praise should be sought, or what kind of blame should be shunned? And when did he practice this discipline which follows these words? Why, then, do you still wonder if in the matters which a man has learned, there he surpasses others, and in those in which he has not been disciplined, there he is? Chapter 17. How we must adapt preconceptions to particular cases. What is the first business of him who philosophizes? To throw away self-conceit. For it is possible for a man to begin to learn that which he thinks that he knows. As to things, then, which ought to be done and ought not to be done, and good and bad, and beautiful and ugly, all of us talking of them at random go to the philosophers, and on these matters we praise, we censure, we accuse, we blame, we judge and determine about principles honorable and dishonorable. But why do we go to the philosophers? Because we wish to learn what we do not think we know. And what is this? Theorems? For we wish to learn what philosophers say as being something elegant and acute, and some wish to learn that they may get profit what they learn. It is ridiculous, then, to think that a person wishes to learn one thing and will learn another, or further, that a man will make proficiency in that which he does not learn. But the many are deceived by this, which deceived also the rhetorician Theopompus, when he blames even Plato for wishing everything to be defined. For what does he say? Did none of us before you use the words good or just? Or do we utter the sounds in an unmeaning and empty way, without understanding what they severally signify? Now, who tells you, Theopompus, that we had not natural notions of each of these things and preconceptions? But it is not possible to adapt preconceptions to their correspondent objects if we have not distinguished them and inquired what object must be subjected to each preconception. You may make... Chapter 18. How should we struggle against appearances? Every habit and faculty is maintained and increased by the corresponding actions. The habit of walking by walking. The habit of running by running. If you would be a good reader, read. If a writer, write. But when you shall not have read 30 days in succession, but have done something else, you will know the consequence. In the same way, if you shall have lain down 10 days, get up and attempt to make a long walk, and you will see how your legs are weakened. Generally, then, if you would make anything a habit, do it. If you would not make it a habit, do not do it, but accustom yourself to do something else in place of it. So it is with respect to the affections of the soul. When you have been angry, you must know that not only has this evil befallen you, but that you have also increased the habit, and in a manner thrown fuel upon fire. When you have been overcome in sexual intercourse with a person, do not reckon this single defeat only, but reckon that you have also nurtured, increased your incontinence. For it is impossible for habits and faculties, some of them not to be produced, when they did not exist before, and others not to be increased and strengthened by corresponding acts. In this manner, certainly, as philosophers say, also diseases of the mind grow up. For when you have once desired money, if reason be applied to lead to a perception of the evil, the desire is stopped, and the ruling faculty of our mind is restored to the original authority. But if you apply no means of cure, it no longer returns to the same state, but being again excited by the corresponding appearance, it is inflamed to desire quicker than before. Chapter 19. Against those who embrace philosophical opinions only in words. The argument called the ruling argument appears to have been proposed from such principles as these. There is, in fact, a common contradiction between one another in these three positions, each two being in contradiction to the third. The propositions are that everything past must of necessity be true, that an impossibility does not follow a possibility, and that a thing is possible which neither is nor will be true. Diodorus, observing this contradiction, employed the probative force of the first two for the demonstration of this proposition, that nothing is possible which is not true and never will be. Now, another will hold these two, that something is possible which is neither true nor ever will be, and that an impossibility does not follow a possibility. But he will not allow that everything which is past is necessarily true, as the followers of Cleanthes seem to think, and Antipater copiously defended them. But others maintain the other two propositions, that a thing is possible which is neither true nor will be true, and that everything which is past is necessarily true. But they will maintain that an impossibility can follow a possibility. But it is impossible to maintain these three positions because of their common contradiction. If then any man should ask me which of these propositions do I maintain, I will answer him that I do not know, but I have received this story, that Diodorus maintained one opinion, the followers of Panthoides, I think, and Cleanthes maintained another opinion, and those of Christ. Chapter 20. Against the Epicureans and Academics. The propositions which are true and evident are of necessity used even by those who contradict them. And a man might perhaps consider it to be the greatest proof of a thing being evident that it is found to be necessary even for him who denies it to make use of it at the same time. For instance, if a man should deny that there is anything universally true, it is plain that he must make the contradictory negation that nothing is universally true. What, wretch, do you not admit even to this? For what else is this than to affirm that whatever is universally affirmed is false? Again, if a man should come forward and say, know that there is nothing that can be known, but all things are incapable of sure evidence. Or if another say, believe me, and you will be the better for it, that a man ought not to believe anything. Or again, if another should say, learn from me, man, that it is not possible to learn anything. I tell you this, and will teach you if you choose. Now, in what respect do these differ from those? Whom shall I name? Those who call themselves academics? Men agree that no man agrees. Believe us that no man believes anybody. Thus, Epicurus also, when he designs to destroy the natural fellowship of mankind, at the same time makes use of that which he destroys. For what does he say? Be not deceived, men, nor be led astray, nor be mistaken. There is no natural fellowship among rational animals, believe me. But those who say otherwise deceive you and seduce you by false reasons. What is this to you? Permit us. Chapter 21 of Inconsistency. Some things men readily confess, and other things they do not. No one, then, will confess that he is a fool or without understanding, but, quite the contrary, you will hear all men saying, I wish that I had fortune equal to my understanding. But readily confess that they are timid, and they say, I am rather timid, I confess, but to other respects you will not find me too foolish. A man will not readily confess that he is intemperate, and that he is unjust he will not confess at all. He will by no means confess that he is envious or a busybody. Most men will confess that they are compassionate. What then is the reason? The chief thing is inconsistency and confusion in the things which relate to good and evil. But different men have different reasons, and generally what they imagine to be base, they do not confess at all. But they suppose timidity to be a characteristic of a good disposition, and compassion also. But silliness to be the absolute characteristic of a slave. And they do not at all admit the things which are offenses against society. But in the case of most errors, for this reason chiefly, they are induced to confess them, because they that there is something involuntarily in them, as in timidity and compassion. And if a man confess that he is in any respect intemperate, he alleges love as an excuse for what is involuntary. But men do not imagine injustice to be at all. There is also in jealousy, as they suppose, something involuntary, and for this reason they confess to jealousy also. Living among such men, who are so confused, so ignorant of what they say, and of evils which they have or have not, and why they have them, or... Chapter 22, On Friendship. What a man applies himself to earnestly, that he naturally loves. Do men then apply themselves earnestly to the things which are bad? By no means. Well, do they apply themselves to things which in no way concern themselves? Not to these either. It remains, then, that they employ themselves earnestly only about things which are good, and if they are earnestly employed about things, they love such things also. Whoever then understands what is good can also know how to love. But he who cannot distinguish good from bad, and things which are neither good nor bad from both, can he possess the power of loving? To love, then, is only in the power of the wise. How is this? A man may say. I am foolish, and yet love my child. I am surprised, indeed, that you have begun by making the admission that you are foolish. For what are you deficient in? Can you not make use of your senses? Do you not distinguish appearances? Do you not use food which is suitable for your body and clothing and habitation? Why, then, do you admit that you are foolish? It is in truth because you are often disturbed by appearances and perplexed, and their power of persuasion often conquers you, and sometimes you think these things to be good, and then the same things to be bad, and lastly neither good nor bad, and, in short, you grieve, fear, envy, are disturbed, you are changed. This is the reason why you confess that you are foolish, and are you not changeable in love? But wealth, and pleasure, and, in a word, things themselves, do you sometimes think them to be good and sometimes bad? And do you not think the same men at one time to be good at another? Chapter 23, On the Power of Speaking. Every man will read a book with more pleasure, or even with more case, if it is written in fairer characters. Therefore, every man will also listen more readily to what is spoken, if it is signified by appropriate and becoming words. We must not say, then, that there is no faculty of expression, for this affirmation is the characteristic of an impious and also of a timid man. Of an impious man, because he undervalues the gifts which come from God, just as if he would take away the commodity of the power of vision, or of hearing, or of seeing. Has, then, God given you eyes to no purpose? And to no purpose has he infused into them a spirit so strong and of such skillful contrivance as to reach a long way and to fashion the forms of things which are seen? What messenger is so swift and vigilant? And to no purpose has he made the interjacent atmosphere so efficacious and elastic that the vision penetrates through the atmosphere, which is in a manner moved? And to no purpose has he made light, without the presence of which there would be no use in any other thing? Man, be neither ungrateful for these gifts, nor yet forget the things which are superior to them. But indeed, for the power of seeing and hearing, and indeed for life itself, and for the things which contribute to support it, for the fruits which are dry, and for wine and oil, give thanks to God. But remember that he has given you something else better than all these. I mean the power of using them, proving them, and estimating the value of each. For what is that which gives information about each of these powers, what each of them is worth? Is it each faculty itself? Chapter 24. To a person who was one of those who was not valued by him. A certain person said to him, "Frequently I desire to hear you and came to you, and you never gave me any answer. And now, if it is possible, I entreat you to say something to me." "Do you think," said Epictetus, "that as there is an art in anything else, so there is also an art in speaking, and that he who has the art will speak skillfully, and he who has not will speak unskillfully?" "I do think so." "He then who by speaking receives benefit himself and is able to benefit others will speak skillfully, but he who is rather damaged by speaking and does damage to others, will he be unskilled in this art of speaking? And you may find that some are damaged and others benefited by speaking. And are all who hear benefited by what they hear? Or will you find that among them also some are benefited and some damaged?" "There are both among these also," he said. "In this case also, then, those who hear skillfully are benefited, and those who hear unskillfully are damaged?" He admitted this. "Is there then a skill in hearing also as there is in speaking?" "It seems so." "If you choose, consider the matter in this way also. The practice of music, to whom does it belong?" "To a musician." "And the proper making of a statue, to whom do you think that it belongs?" "To a statuary." "And the looking at a statue skillfully, does this appear to you to require the aid of no art?" "This also requires the aid of art." "Then, if speaking properly is the business of the skillful man, do you see that to hear also with benefit is the business of the skillful man?" Now, chapter 25, that logic is necessary. When one of those who were present said, "Persuade me that logic is necessary," he replied, "Do you wish me to prove this to you?" The answer was, "Yes." "Then I must use a demonstrative form of speech." This was granted. "How then will you know if I am cheating you by argument?" The man was silent. "Do you see," said Epictetus, "that you yourself are admitting that logic is necessary? If without it you cannot know so much as this, whether logic is necessary or not necessary." Chapter 26. What is the property of error? Every error comprehends contradiction. For since he who errs does not wish to err, but to be right, it is plain that he does not do what he wishes. For what does the thief wish to do? That which is for his own interest. If then the theft is not for his interest, he does not do that which he wishes. But every rational soul is by nature offended at contradiction, and so long as it does not understand this contradiction, it is not hindered from doing contradictory things. But when it does understand the contradiction, it must of necessity avoid the contradiction, and avoid it as much as a man must dissent from the false when he sees that a thing is false. But so long as this falsehood does not appear to him, he assents to it as to truth. He then is strong in argument, and has the faculty of exhorting and confuting, who is able to show to each man the contradiction through which he errs, and clearly to prove how he does not do that which he wishes, and does that he does not wish. For if anyone shall show this, a man will himself withdraw from that which he does. But so long as you do not show this, do not be surprised if a man persists in his practice. For having the appearance of doing right, he does what he does. For this reason, Socrates, also trusting to this power, used to say, I am used to call no other witness of what I say, but I am always satisfied with him with whom I am discussing, and I ask him to give his opinion and call him as a witness, and though he is only one, he is sufficient in the place of all. For Socrates knew by what the rational soul is moved, just like a pair of scales, and that it must incline whether it chooses or not. This has been The Discourses of Epictetus by Epictetus, narrated by Russell Newton. To learn more about today's author or book, please visit Amazon.com or Audible.com. Show notes and further information can be found at RussellEricNewton.com. With a collection of trivia, research, news stories, and knowledge from some of the newest audiobooks on the market, this has been the Voice Over Work Podcast, brought to you by Newton Media Group, a family of creative services.